Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for December 20th, 2016. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Mark Diron about a mechanism by which an Fc receptor can inhibit signaling by other receptors even without co-clustering with those other receptors. Antibodies play a crucial role in adaptive immunity because they bind to pathogens and infected cells. The FAB regions of antibodies bind to antigens, and the Fc regions of antibodies bind to Fc receptors on immune cells, which causes these receptors to aggregate into clusters. Many different types of immune cells have Fc receptors, and activation of Fc receptors elicits different responses in different types of cells. For example, activation of Fc receptors on phagocytes induces these cells to ingest the antigen-antibody complex and destroy the antigen. In mast cells and basophils, Fc receptors are involved in allergies and autoimmune activation. In these cells, the response depends upon which specific Fc receptors are present in a cluster. Fc receptor aggregation can either stimulate signaling and activate these cells, which promotes inflammation, or aggregation can inhibit signaling and prevent these cells from being activated. A group led by Mark Diron at the Institut Pasteur and INSERM has identified a mechanism whereby one type of Fc receptor can inhibit signaling by another type of Fc receptor without even being present in the same receptor complex. Diron spoke to me from Paris. Hello, Dr. Diron. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Hello.
How are mast cells and basophils involved in allergic inflammation and autoimmune inflammation?
Well, mast cells and basophils, they are myeloid cells. They are among the many myeloid cells that pass well in the body and that ensure innate immunity primarily, but not only. These two cells have a particular feature. They are filled with granules that are full of preformed mediators that include vasoactive amines, such as histamine, but also many enzymes, among which there are proteases which are fully active. They are, and it is a good thing that they are enclosed in the granules, otherwise it would destroy all the proteins around. And when the cells are activated, the granules are expelled through a process of exocytosis or degranulation that takes only a few minutes. And these results in the release of all these things that are contained in the granules. But also when activated, the mast cells and the basophils, they also secrete newly formed mediators. And these are many. Some are newly synthesized, such as leukotrienes and prostaglandins. And others are newly transcribed, and these include chemokines, cytokines, growth factors. And altogether, these products generate an acute inflammatory reaction. And depending on the location, this reaction can be more or less local or general. The more very local, it might be a very mild little thing at a simple place, or it can be, at most, it can be systemic, such as in the anaphylactic shock. And depending on the stimulus, they can generate allergic inflammation or autoimmune inflammation.
And speaking of the stimulus, what sorts of stimuli activate those cells?
Mast cells and basophils, well, they express toll-like receptors, those receptors that are involved in innate immunity, and they do respond to this, and they play a role in the defenses against a number of pathogens. But these cells can also be activated when antigen and antibody engage receptors for antibodies that they express on their surface. And mast cells and basophils express, let's say, two main types of receptors. Some receptors have an affinity for IgA. They are called Fc epsilon receptors. And others have an affinity for IgG, and they are called Fc gamma receptors. Now, these cells can be activated when antigen and antibodies engage these receptors, and antibodies against allergen induce allergic inflammation, whereas antibodies against autoantigen induce autoimmune inflammation. Now, in allergy, allergen binds to IgE that is already bound to Fc epsilon receptors, and this activates mast cells and basophils. Now, in autoimmune diseases, mast cells have been involved in many diseases, autoimmune diseases, such as multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjögren's syndrome, autoimmune thyroiditis. On the other hand, basophils have been recently involved in autoimmune diseases, and particularly in systemic lupus erythematosus. And when activated by IgE and autoantibodies, the basophils in these patients, home to secondary lymphoid organs where they secrete cytokines that support plasma cell survival and autoantibody production. So see that mast cells and basophils are really major actors, primarily in allergy, but not only in allergy, also in autoimmune diseases.
How do the Fc receptors on those cells control whether or not the cells are activated by an antigen-antibody complex?
When engaging Fc receptors, antibodies do not always or do not necessarily activate mast cells and basophils. The reason is twofold. First, these cells express two types of receptors. Some are activating receptors, others are inhibitory receptors. Activating receptors include IgE receptors, the high-affinity IgE receptors, the classical one that are involved in allergy, and also IgG receptors that are also activating, and they are different in human and mice. There are Fc gamma R3a in mouse and Fc gamma R2a in humans. But the difference for what we are talking about is not very important. Now, the inhibitory receptors, they have also a terrible name. This is Fc gamma R2. They are low-affinity IgG receptors. Now, when co-engaged by antibodies and antigen, these two types of receptors generate antagonistic signals in the same cells, and the integration of these signals determines the cellular response. Now, the second reason why the Fc receptors do not necessarily activate the mast cells is that even activating receptors are not that simple. They do not generate activation signals only, but a mixture of activation and inhibition signals that antagonize each other. So, in general, signals are dominantly activating when the receptors are engaged by relatively low concentrations of antigen. So low or moderate receptor engagement induces activation signals that are dominant. Whereas in the presence of higher concentration of antigen, for instance, a high or hyper receptor engagement induces signals in which inhibition signals are dominant. Now, how does inhibition work? Inhibition signals are due to the recruitment of an enzyme. It's a lipid phosphatase, which is named SHIP or SHIP1, S-H-I-P. And what it does is to hydrolyze an intracellular second messenger, which is essential, which is called phosphatidyl inositol trisphosphate. Let's call it PIP3. And this phospholipid is very important in the signaling process because it enables the recruitment of a variety of signaling molecules that are necessary to generate and to convey activation signals intracellularly. The reason why inhibitory receptors are inhibitory receptors, such as Fc gamma R2b, is simply that they recruit much higher amounts of SHIP1 than activating receptors.
And that's the process that you refer to as cis inhibition.
Yes. SHIP1 is recruited where the activation signals are generated in the same receptor complex and inhibits these signals. And we call this cis inhibition because everything happens in the same aggregate. So cis inhibition can be defined as a local inhibition of those signals that are generated by activating receptors with which the inhibitor receptors have been recruited and co-engaged.
In this paper, you found that the inhibitory receptor can also inhibit signaling of the activating receptors even when it doesn't aggregate with them in a process that's different from cis inhibition. Can you explain that process?
Yes, yeah. What we found is that besides this cis inhibitory process, this local phenomena, we found that SHIP can inhibit other signals that are triggered elsewhere in the cell, but are triggered by other activating receptors than those with which the inhibitor receptors are co-aggregated. So as a result, inhibitor receptors, when recruiting SHIP, inhibit both C SIS signals that are generated next to the place where a ship has been recruited, but also signals that are distant in the cell. So what we found is that if you co-ligate a subset of these receptors carrying antibodies of a given specificity with inhibitory receptors, you can inhibit not only the signals generated by these activating receptors, but also the signal generated by other receptors that are independently induced by another antigen of the same cell. Now, how can this happen? This can happen because PIP3, it's a small molecule that is hooked to the membrane because it's a phospholipid, and PIP3 diffuses in the plane of the membrane, and it can move from the signalosome where it was generated to diffuse on the membrane all over the cell. So it can very logically meet SHIP1, where SHIP1 was recruited by another receptor. Now, to summarize, I think that one to understand that transinhibition, we call this transinhibition. One has to understand that transinhibition requires two steps. The first step is whatever, anything that leads to the recruitment of SHIP1 in activating signalosomes. This is the induction phase. And this is, of course, primarily done by the inhibitory receptors when they are co-engaged with activating receptors. Now, the second step is the effector phase, which is due to SHIP, which hydrolyzes PIP3. Whether it was generated in the same signalosome, and this is cis inhibition, or in independent signalosome, and this is transinhibition.
Can the inhibitory Fc receptors, through this transinhibition mechanism, inhibit signaling only from other Fc receptors, or can it also inhibit signaling from unrelated types of receptors?
Well, of course, this is a question that we examined because on the basis of this mechanism, we could hypothesize that transinhibition would indeed affect other signals than those that are triggered by Fc receptors. We anticipated that it could affect all the receptors that use PIP3 as a signaling molecule, and there are many, actually. So we found two things. We found that transinhibition indeed could affect not only activation signals, but also proliferation signals. And because we use mast cells as a model system, we looked at the proliferative response of mast cells that are induced by cytokine receptors, such as IL-3 receptors, or by growth factor receptors, such as KIT. These two types of receptors do not signal at all the same way. One is a cytokine receptor that uses JAK-STAT, whereas the growth factor receptor, KIT, is a receptor tyrosine kinase, but both use PIP3 as an intermediate. And we found that indeed, when we co-ligated inhibitory IgG receptors with activating IgE receptors on the mast cells, these proliferative signals were diminished and the cells did not proliferate as efficiently as before. But maybe more importantly, and to some extent quite surprisingly, we next examine whether this transinhibition could affect the constitutive proliferation of a tumor cell, of a transformed cells. What we found is that when we co-ligated the activating IgG receptors with inhibitory receptors on these cells, we could stop the in vitro proliferation of these cells. And if we incubated these cells with the ligands to do this co-ligation before we injected the cells subcutaneously to immunocompromised recipient mice, we just stopped the development of tumors. So clearly, transinhibition can affect other responses than those that are induced by Fc receptors themselves.
Are these mechanisms of cis inhibition and transinhibition specific to mast cells and basophils, or do they also occur in other types of immune cells?
Well, first of all, the cis inhibition has been observed in many other cells, so cis inhibition is clearly not restricted to mast cells and basophils. On the mechanistic basis of what we just discussed, it would be surprising if it were restricted to these cells. We have already indirect evidence that this can happen because it was published by others and us before that B cell could be possibly transinhibited, although the mechanism was not elucidated, when Fc gamma receptors were co-engaged with BCR, the B cell antigen receptors on B cells. This not only cis-inhibited the signal generated by the BCR, but also the migration response of these cells to a chemokine that goes through another type of receptors. So it's pretty likely, although not formally demonstrated, that transinhibition can operate in other cells. And in general, I think that we can probably expect that transinhibition will work in every cell that express receptors that can recruit SHIP and could control processes that are due in these cells to any receptor that is PIP3. And I would say in general, I would anticipate that many cells of the hematopoietic lineage should be susceptible to be transinhibited.
Does this transinhibition mechanism have any potential application for treating allergies or autoimmunity?
Well, of course, at this stage, it's a little premature to sell something that does not exist anymore. But what we have found is just a phenomenon. And on this basis, we can try to think about what could be derived from this. But from a general point of view, I would say that better understanding regulatory mechanisms that control the activation and the proliferation of cells that are themselves involved in inflammatory processes, which are themselves responsible for disease, is obviously a means to devise tools that might have a potential therapeutic interest. I would say that the goal would be to induce transinhibition in target cells by co-engaging inhibitory receptors with activating receptors. First of all, depending on the receptors that you target, you will also aim at specific cells. Therefore, it might restrict the transinhibition to those cells which are targeted through the receptors that they engage. Due to these observations that we have made, that transinhibition could affect the constitutive proliferation of tumor cells, well, of course, it opens the possibility that some proliferative disorders might benefit of transinhibition. But of course, again, what we provided here is not even a proof of concept. It's a conceptual basis of something that has to be thought and engineered and tried, of course.
Mark, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
That was Mark Diron discussing a paper published in the December 20th issue of Science Signaling by Malbec and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. On behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.